Hello and welcome to New World Witchery's Folk Magician's Notebook, episode for April 2022. These are short monthly episodes that will offer a brief overview of folk magical topics and information that might be useful to you over the coming month. As always, we highly recommend that you also pick up a copy of a reputable and reliable almanac for folk magic, such as the Witch's Almanac, Llewellyn's Witch's Datebook, or your local farmer's almanac. Let's take a look at the moon and stars for April 2022. Our new moon date is April 1st. Is this a fool's dark moon, perhaps? The full moon date is April 16th and will be known as the pink moon. We start off the entire month on April Fool's Day, reveling in the topsy-turvy world of pranks and fool kings being elevated. This tradition is connected back to the Mardi Gras traditions involving the Feast of Fools or similar events where carnival goers would switch roles, masters becoming servants and servants masters for the day, although everyone was careful not to take those reversals too far. This month, our new moon is on April Fool's Day in Aries, which will also be our sun sign transition for the month. This is a good time for activities, celebration, revels, and just generally kicking up your heels and having a good time. The moon will continue growing through Taurus, Gemini, and Cancer until the 9th, making it a good time for dealing with anything that needs to grow those long tendril-like appendages, roots and vines for plants, for example, or pursuing new passions as well as rekindling old ones in a more metaphorical sense. By the time we move into the first quarter and beyond, those earthly energetic days will be settling a little, and it'll be time to nourish the things you've planted. Establish regular practices, such as watering and planting schedules, or routines for learning the ukulele, if that's one of your projects. The presence of Leo around the 10th to the 13th would also make it a good time to reward yourself with something for the work you've been doing. The full moon occurs in Libra and moves quickly into Scorpio, which makes for some good introspective time. It's a pink moon, associated with springtime both because of the pastel color and the early blooming of phlox flowers, or pinks as they're sometimes called. It's also the Paschal full moon, meaning it sets the date for the upcoming Easter holiday for those who celebrate. That means it's an end to the Lenten season, so celebrations are in order here too, although one's less frenetic than those around the first of the month. Springtime symbols abound, lambs, flowers, chicks, and rabbits. And it's also a time that makes for good work with Dianic forces. If you've ever needed a night to moonbathe, this is a good, solid choice. As the moon wanes into the last portion of the month, we'll see a potential partial solar eclipse as we pass back into Taurus with our second dark moon of the month. This is sometimes called a black moon and will occur on the 30th. It's a time for spirit contact, introspective work, divination, and maybe even sealing away unwanted things into the dark. Some magicians advise caution when working with these forces, but they have been a focus of work for a number of other practitioners, so play with the tides of a dark moon at your own discretion and use your best judgment there. Oh, and get ready for the very delicious revels coming up on Walpurgisnacht as we move from April to May, of course. Now we'll take a look at the cards, divination, and a proverb for the month. Our playing card of the month is the King of Clubs, which represents a father, a judge, or a general. And I should note, I've had some questions about this. This comes largely from my own experience as a reader and a lot of information that you can find in my book, 54 Devils, which is all about the art and folklore of fortune telling with playing cards. There are links, of course, in the show notes for that. So the King of Clubs, a father, a judge, a general. This card, it can be off-putting to some, because the King of Clubs might seem haughty or callous or even kind of distant and cold, but I want to emphasize he doesn't have to be. As a father, he can be a figure that brings experience, compassion, and wisdom to bear on a particular event. As a judge, he will hopefully offer you sage counsel on a tricky or troublesome issue. As a general, he can provide concrete decision-making when it comes to having overwhelming choices. So when he comes up in a reading, I often think of him as more like an older figure that has a fatherly presence in the querent's life. In some cases, that figure can be one that does dominate, but in many cases, it's not. Instead, it's a person who wants the best for you and thinks they know how to help you get what you want. But crucially, they don't always know. The clubs are not a suit of intuition, but work and business. So this can be the kind of person who wants to, quote unquote, fix things, when what you really want is just to vent or talk about it. Knowing that can make relating to this person easier, but it's also still a little frustrating, I know. In the end, I hope you'll remember that the King of Clubs is not an intentional antagonist, even if they are an accidental one sometimes. Our tarot card of the month is the Emperor. This card exudes Aries energy because it represents judgment or the Freudian superego that guides the impulses of the ego and the id. It is like the King of Clubs, a bit of a father figure, albeit a little more remote due to his imperial nature. Crucially, though, there's a lot riding on his decisions. He must attempt to, Solomon-like, dispense wisdom to those who seek him. And sometimes that wisdom leaves people feeling hurt or unsatisfied. He's usually depicted on tarot cards with images of rams on his throne or in the background because he must stand resolute and firm, and often confront a problem, quote-unquote, head-on. That Aries symbolism also means he's always ready to climb higher, achieve more, and sometimes that means that he cannot see the dangers of falling clearly enough. He is law and justice and authority, but his judgments need a balancing force of compassion and humanity sometimes, or they can become impersonal. They are commitments to the letter of the law without taking into account its spirit, or a tenacious dedication to oaths and contracts, even when circumstances change and dictate a new direction to go. The Emperor, then, is wise and decisive and can be a very good card to get if you need direction, but he also leaves a space open for more subjective, compassionate forces that will keep any decisions grounded in the real world and the lived experiences of those dwelling there. The folk divination method of the month is fire scrying. This month, I thought we'd look at a couple of different methods for gaining answers from that most Aries of elements, fire. One of the most common ways to gain insight from fire is by using candles to scry or intuitively discern information. Some people will watch the movements of a flame or smoke as they sit in front of a candle, for example, and begin to get impressions based on the dancing tongues of fire or fume. Another very useful way to do this that adds a new level of depth, literally, is a candle scrying method using a bowl of water or even a mirror. To perform this method, you place the mirror or bowl of water, preferably a stone bowl without designs at the bottom, but you do what works for you, between yourself and the candle. Then you'd watch the candle's reflection on the glass or the surface of the water. Those who use this method sometimes find that they get the sensation of falling into the dark pool towards the flame, and the trance therein becomes very revelatory by providing whispers of information, fleeting glances of imagery, or even a full-on trip into the other world. Another candle divination method involves lighting a glass-encased candle, like a traditional novena candle, and asking it questions while repeating particular incantations or prayers over it. Then, when the candle is burned out, the soot patterns left on the side of the glass are red for symbols, much like tea leaves. If there are no soot patterns, it's often a good sign that things will go well, while the soot can offer additional insights into more complicated answers. If the glass shatters, that's a wholly different sign, and one that may mean it's time to put up some magical shields. Finally, my favorite form of fire scrying is to simply sit before a fire that's burning down to embers and watch the glowing red coals. My mind will unfocus, then become lost in the slowly changing patterns, and I begin to get impressions of answers, ideas, or thoughts that help respond to whatever problem I'm thinking about at the time. Frequently, I couple this with a fire leaping ritual too, which would be perfect for the upcoming May Day holidays, in fact. As a final note, please do practice safe hex and never leave burning fires or candles unattended, and always have an extinguishing method close to hand. Our witch's proverb of the month: it's better to be dirty at home than clean in the cemetery. No! Our folktale of the month is the story of the fisherman and the djinn. Originally found in the Alf Lalo Wa Lalo, or 1001 Nights, the version I'm telling here will be drawn from a version found in the Andrew Lang translation of that book. Once upon a time, there was a fisherman so old and poor that he could scarcely manage to support his wife and children. He went every day to fish early, and he made a rule not to throw his nets more than 4 times. He started out one morning by moonlight and came to the seashore. He undressed and threw his nets, and as he was drawing them towards the bank, he felt a great weight. He thought he'd caught a large fish. He was very pleased. But a moment after, seeing instead of a fish, he'd only caught his nets the carcass of an ass, he was very disappointed. Vexed with having such a bad haul, when he mended his nets, in which the carcass of the ass had broken several pieces, he threw them again a second time. And drawing them in again, he felt a great weight, and he thought they were very full of fish, but this time he found only a large basket full of rubbish. He was much annoyed.
"Oh, fortune," he cried, "do not trifle thus with me, a poor fisherman who can hardly support his family."
And so saying, he threw away the rubbish, and after having washed his nets clean, he threw them for a third time, but this time only drew in stones and shells and mud. He was most in despair, and so he threw his nets for the 4th time. When he thought he had a fish, he drew them up with a great deal of trouble, but there was no fish. Instead, there was a yellow pot, which seemed by its weight very full of something, and he noticed it was fastened and sealed with lead, with the impression of some sort of a seal. He was delighted.
"I could sell this to the founder of the city," he said. "With the money I shall get, I shall go buy a measure of wheat."
He examined the jar on all sides. He shook it to see if it would rattle, but he heard nothing. And so, judging from the impression of the seal on the lid, he thought there must be something precious inside. To find out, he took out his knife, and with a little trouble, he managed to wedge it open. He turned it upside down, but nothing came out, which surprised him very much, and he set it down in front of him. While he was looking at it, though, a thick smoke came out. He stepped back a pace or two. The smoke rose up into the clouds, stretching out over the sea and the shore, forming a thick mist, which caused the fisherman much astonishment and fear. When the smoke was all out of the jar, it gathered itself together and became a thick mass, which took the form of a djinn twice as large as the largest giant. When he saw such a terrible-looking monster, the fisherman would have run away, but he trembled with fright so that he couldn't move a step.
"Great king of the djinn," cried the monster, "I will never again disobey you."
Well, at these words, the fisherman took courage.
"What is this you're saying, great djinn? Tell me your history and how you came to be shut up in that vase."
At this, the djinn looked at the fisherman haughtily.
"Speak to me more civilly," he said, "before I kill you."
"Ah, why should you kill me?" cried the fisherman. "I've just freed you. Have you forgotten that already?"
"No," answered the djinn, "but that will not prevent me from killing you, and I will grant you only one favor. That is to choose the manner of your death."
"But what have I done to you?" asked the fisherman.
"I cannot treat you in any other way," said the djinn, "and if you would know why, listen to my story. I rebelled against the great king of the djinn. To punish me, he shut me up in this vase of copper and put a leaden seal cover on it, which had enchantment enough to prevent my coming out. Then he had the vase thrown into the sea. During the first period of my captivity, I vowed that if anyone should free me before 100 years were past, I would make him rich even after his death. But that century passed away, and no one freed me. So in the 2nd century, I vowed that I would give all the treasures in the world to my deliverer. But he never came. In the 3rd, I promised to make him a king, to be always at his right side, and to grant him 3 wishes every day. But that century passed away as the other 2 had done, and I remained in the same plight. At last, I grew angry at being captive for so long, and I vowed that if anyone would release me, I would kill him at once, and allow him only to choose the manner by which he should die. So, you see, as you have freed me today, choose in what way you shall perish."
The fisherman was very unhappy.
"What an unlucky man I am to have freed you. I implore you to spare my life."
"I have told you," said the djinn, That is impossible. Choose quickly, you are wasting time.
The fisherman thought and thought, and finally struck upon an idea.
Well, since I must die, he said, before I choose the manner of my death, I demand of you, on your honor, to tell me if you were really in that little vase.
Yes, I was, answered the djinn.
I do not believe it, said the fisherman. That vase could not contain one of your feet. How could your whole body go in? I won't believe it unless I see you do the thing.
Well, at that, the djinn began to change himself into smoke, which, as before, spread over the sea and the shore, and which, then collecting itself together, began to go back into the vase slowly and evenly until there was nothing left outside. And a voice came from inside the vase, which said to the fisherman,
"Well, unbelieving fisherman, here I am in the vase. Do you believe me now?"
But instead of an answer, the fisherman took the lid of lead and shut it down quickly on the vase.
"Now, O djinn," he cried, "ask pardon of me and choose by what death you will die. Ha, but no, 'twill be better if I throw you into the sea whence I drew you out, and I'll build a little house on the shore to warn fishermen who come to cast their nets here against fishing up such a wicked djinn as you, who vows to kill the man who frees you."
At these words, the djinn did all he could to get out, but he could not because of the enchantment on the lid. Then he tried to get out by cunning.
"If you take off the cover," he said, "I will make you the richest man alive."
"Ah, you will do no such thing. You will repay me only in death," said the fisherman.
"If you let me out," cried the djinn, "I shall make you a king and grant you 3 wishes a day.
Ah, if I release you, you shall give me only 3 blows that lead to my death. I know you well enough."
And with that, the fisherman took the bottle and threw it hurling back into the sea once he had found it. He returned home, perhaps with no fish and no money, but with his life, and that was a great enough boon for him. In the story of the fisherman and the djinn, I think we often find ourselves rooting for the fisherman to outwit the angry djinn, and there's nothing wrong with that. But sometimes I feel as if the djinn gets too short a straw in the overall narrative. He's been sealed up, yes, because of his rebellious nature, but wasn't he just a very young djinn and all? Don't we all make mistakes when we're, you know, only a few thousand years old? All kidding aside, the djinn's anger has always fascinated me in the story because it seems like a form of grief. He begins by promising wealth and power if he's only released, notably after a full century each time, so this opportunity is not exactly limited time. Only after he's been kept in captivity for nearly half a millennium does he shift into rage and vengeance. Crucially, though, he dedicates and commits himself to that anger, to that fury. He makes an oath that he will offer only a choice of death, no tea and cake available, I suppose. Oaths are powerful things, in magic too, especially when dealing with spirits. The oath in this story is what binds the djinn to his quest for retribution, even after he's freed. Note that upon his first release, he's acquiescent, and only changes his tune when he realizes that the king of the djinn is not the one who freed him. His oath to that king was broken, and so he had lost his power. Restoring that oath might have set him right, but the king of the djinn, which in the Ahlaylah wa Laylah or Arabian Nights version is usually thought to be Solomon of Jewish lore, that king is long gone, and so his next level oath kicks in. I don't think it's a stretch to imagine that the fisherman missed something of an opportunity here. The djinn would have made him an oath and granted what he desired, all in exchange for freedom. Making an oath in magic is important, but it's also important to understand the boundaries of the contracts we forge. Some of the best examples of folk tales where these Faustian or diabolical bargains are really stories about someone exploiting loopholes rather than fulfilling them. Think only of the clever Jack stories about Jack outwitting the devil, for example. If you're a person who works with magic, are you thinking about the commitments you make and how you can honor them? Are you leaving space for grace and ways to fulfill them in alternate ways? Something like maybe a loophole. Many folk magicians I know maintain altars to ancestors, spirits, or saints, and they worry about missing a day when they're supposed to make an offering of incense or water or food. Yet I know very few who haven't missed a day at least once. So what do? Most of the time they make an effort to reconnect, to renew that relationship in another way. A contract, an oath, an obligation. All of these are really a relationship of responsibility. And relationships are alive. They change and grow. In the story of the fisherman and the djinn, that oath could have been renewed, rewritten. A powerful friendship might have been forged between a djinn who had seen a lowly fisherman become his equal in cunning. Oh, what fun they could have had together. Whatever contracts or oaths you're making in your life, to spirits, to others, or to yourself, I hope you find ways to fulfill them that leave you feeling whole and invigorated rather than angry or resentful. And more importantly, that you're building those oaths on the backs of living, evolving, and mutually beneficial relationships. You deserve that. And so do the spirits, people, gods, etc., that you work with. We'll finish up our notebook entry with a little charm or craft each month to add a practical element to your work. This time, I'd like to walk you through making a simple oil lamp out of an old jar, a slice of cork, and some wicking. Oil lamps are a form of lighting in magical work older than candles, and they're actually surprisingly easy to make. It's best to use an oil with a high smoke point, like peanut, avocado, almond, or sunflower, but even olive oil will work. To make this, you need a cork, made of real cork, not plastic. And you can often find those by asking relatives, friends, or even a bartender for them. A solid glass jar like a canning jar, nothing with walls that are too thin. Some aluminum foil, and a bit of wicking, which is found easily at most craft stores. You want to slice a circle of cork about a quarter of an inch thick. You can go a little thinner if you like. Punch a hole in the center of the cork using a nail or something similarly sharp. Make a circle of the aluminum foil about the same size as the cork, and then cut a tiny little X in the center of it. Place it on top of the cork circle, and then draw the wick up through the bottom of the cork and through the foil circle through the X, so that the cork won't burn when you light it. Give yourself a good inch or so of wick above the cork if you can, and now fill your jar with oil about two-thirds of the way up. Lower your wick into the oil slowly and try to let it settle against the bottom of the jar. You can trim if you need to, but it's also fine to leave a little bit of it curled around the base. Let the foil-covered cork and wick float on top of the oil for a few minutes to a few hours so that the oil can soak into the wick. Trim it, and light it. It should continue to burn with a low flame, but you can pull up more wick or trim it down as you desire to change the height of the flame. This is a great basic tool for fire scrying, but it can also become a great magical working tool too. If you want to add some herbs or stones or other magical ingredients to the jar before putting the wick in, you can do that. For example, a lamp to make a space friendlier and more inviting might have a bit of brown sugar, some allspice berries, and a cinnamon stick or two in it. These won't give it much aroma, especially not right away, although they might add a little scent over time, but they will carry your magical intent wherever the light goes. Always make sure to put the oil lamp in a heat-proof surface and never leave it burning unattended. Well, that's it for this entry into your New World Witchery Folk Magician's Notebook. Thank you so much for joining us this month. We hope you have a wonderful month ahead of you, full of lots of adventures and excitement, very much Aries season now. If you'd like to help support our show and our work, we would certainly welcome that. You can do so at patreon.com/newworldwitchery, where you can pledge $1 a month or whatever you can afford to help keep the show alive and fresh and doing amazing things, or at least interesting things, we hope, throughout the coming months. You can also find us lots of places if you have feedback for us on this show or any other. You can write to us at compassandkey@gmail.com or at newworldwitcherypodcast@gmail.com. Both of those will come to us. You can visit our website, newworldwitchery.com, where you can find the show notes for this episode, all of the 200-plus other episodes we've got, and over 200 articles on various types of folk magic as well. You can find us on a number of social media sites. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and even a few others as well floating around out there. So if you want to get in touch with us through social media, we are out there. So come find us. You can find us pretty much anywhere. You can find out where we are and all the different things about us by going to our links page, which is newworldwitchery.com/find-us, if that helps you find more about us. That will basically do it this time around. I hope you enjoyed this one. I hope you're looking forward to the upcoming Walpurgisnacht festivities. I know I am. So until then, thanks for listening. Be well.